Thank you all for coming. It's time to get started with our panel discussion here. Our panelists today to discuss whether the U.S. Constitution requires states to recognize same-sex marriages consists of Jonathan Adler, Edward Whalen, and Mark Strasser. Professor Adler is a professor of law at Case Western Reserve University. You may be familiar with him also for his work as a blogger on the Vala Conspiracy blog. Mr. Whalen is president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, and you may be familiar with him for his work on the National Review Bench Memos blog. And Professor Strasser is professor of law at Capital University of Law School, and he is the author or editor of 6 books, including several on the topic that we're discussing here today. So each of them is going to come up. They're going to speak for 7 minutes on the topic. Then we'll have some back and forth between them, and then you'll be able to ask your questions. So Professor Adler, you'll go first, and I welcome you to come to the lectern.
Sure. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back here. Glad the weather is so nice in Columbus. It took me less time to drive here from Cleveland this morning than it did to get home last night from my office. So I'm glad that we have nice, sunny, brisk weather as opposed to lake effect. I want to begin by kind of saying, at least for me, what we're talking about, what we're not talking about, before saying what we are talking about. As far as I'm concerned, the question before us today is not whether or not gay marriage is desirable, whether or not on moral or other grounds or prudential grounds, for example, it's something that we should adopt or allow. As a matter of fact, I support gay marriage. I believe that that allowing gay marriage is the right thing to do and would be good for society. But the question before us is not, is gay marriage a good or bad thing? Is it something that makes sense for the United States today? Not even really whether or not the state has any business at all at deciding what sorts of private arrangements individuals should or should not be allowed to enter into, but whether or not the U.S. Constitution, the one we have, not the one we might want or might have written were it up to us, requires that gay marriage be recognized throughout the United States. Whether or not, to put it another way, the Constitution prohibits states from maintaining the traditional definition of marriage as it has been understood throughout our nation's history and throughout most of Western history as a union of a man and a woman. And there, I think, the answer, at least to me, is quite clearly that the Constitution does not bar states from upholding and protecting and defending and maintaining that traditional definition of marriage, even though I'm someone that would prefer that more states did not do so. I think I'm not going to spend much time on the original public meaning of the Constitution's text, because I think the arguments there are rather clear. I think most people would accept that the original public meaning of the Constitution as amended does not require recognition of same-sex marriage, but I don't think that existing doctrine does either. There are basically two lines of argument that are traditionally made in defense of same-sex marriage or being constitutionally protected. One is under the Due Process Clause, the other is under the Equal Protection Clause, and I think both these arguments are unavailing and unconvincing. Under the Due Process Clause, we know from a long line of cases that those rights that are protected as fundamental are those that are deeply rooted in our nation's history and traditions. That is the test that the Supreme Court embraced in Washington versus Glucksberg, and is the test that the court has embraced in numerous decisions. Given that that's the test, it's to me rather inconceivable that maintaining the traditional definition of marriage that pre-exists our nation's founding is somehow incompatible with the nation's deeply rooted history and traditions. There's nothing to stop states from departing from those traditions and allowing more than they have, but it can't be the case that the nation's history and traditions prohibits states from maintaining the definition of marriage as it has been understood. And I think if one looks at the various substantive due process cases that we've seen over the last 50 years, you actually see this recognition. One can go back, for example, and look at cases like Griswold versus Connecticut and see the opinions of, for example, Justice Goldberg and Justice Harlan saying that the due process clause would not even prohibit criminalizing homosexual conduct. Now, I don't support criminalizing homosexual conduct. I find any laws regarding consensual sexual conduct among adults to be quite offensive. But even the roots of modern substantive due process jurisprudence made very clear that in recognizing certain liberties in the context of marriage did not entail allowing any sort of liberties that we might think are important today that were not always recognized as important. But what about equal protection? The reality is that the Supreme Court has never recognized or held that sexual preference is a protected class. So the relevant test is rational basis. It's not a very demanding test. We can look back at the various rational basis cases, whether it's Williamson versus Lee Optical or Railway Express or Beezer or any of these various cases, and we see that the requirement for rational basis is not, do we like the arguments? Do we find them compelling? Are they not over or under inclusive? It's simply, does the state have a legitimate interest, and is there some rational relationship to that interest? The way I usually describe this to my students is, what you're basically asking is, could a non-corrupt state actor make these arguments in good faith? And to be honest, some of the rational basis precedents we have even push that very meager test to the limit, especially in the context of economic liberties, where it's very clear that a lot of the laws that have been upheld are about punishing one group for the benefit of another. And in the context of marriage, there are quite a few arguments that, again, while I don't find compelling as a policy matter, are certainly rational. That is to say, people of goodwill, in good faith, can argue that maintaining traditional family structure is good because of its roots to our nation's traditions, because of it, of the environment it creates and makes possible for the raising of children, and so on. These are all these sorts of arguments, again, may or may not be outweighed by other considerations as a policy matter. But as a constitutional matter, that's not our test. Our test is, are they rational and are they connected to legitimate state interests? And I think quite clearly they are. And we often hear, well, if we don't have to allow gay marriage, what does that do with marriage between, say, infertile couples and the like? But again, under the rational basis test, we know that over-inclusivity and under-inclusivity aren't problems. They are under strict scrutiny, but that's not where we are. I know that I'm just about out of time, so let me say make two other quick points. One is, let's just say we wanted to say this should be subject to heightened scrutiny. It should be subject to intermediate scrutiny because distinguishing same-sex marriage from heterosexual marriage does involve a gender-based classification. I still think even if we were to apply intermediate scrutiny, that the argument fails. There are many cases, including some from the immigration context, where we differentiate citizen fathers from citizen mothers in terms of how parental rights and citizenship of children are established, where intermediate scrutiny allows for recognizing differences between genders as the basis of public policy. And I don't think that creates a problem here. The last point I'll make, because I know I'm about to get roped from the stage, is that we need to remember that not everything that we might find objectionable or unjust is unconstitutional. We needed to amend our Constitution to prohibit racial discrimination by states. We had to amend our Constitution to give women the right to vote. Those were both good things for us to have done, but we couldn't simply say the Constitution mandates this. We had to amend it. We had to, in Frederick Douglass's characterization, remove some of the scaffolding that obscured the cathedral of the principles that our Constitution was based on. If we want gay marriage to be constitutionally required, then we would also have to amend our Constitution. If we fail to do so, then it is one of the many questions that is left to the vagaries of the political process. Thank you.
thank you. My views on the constitutional question largely parallel those of Jonathan, so I'll try not to be redundant and instead develop some new ground. But again, I want to emphasize the constitutional question is sharply distinct from the policy question. My basic position, the Constitution doesn't speak one way or the other to the question of same-sex marriage. It leaves the matter to the political processes for resolution. It's constitutionally permissible to retain traditional marriage laws. It's also constitutionally permissible to redefine marriage laws to include same-sex marriage. So as strong as my own views are in support of the policy of traditional marriage, I don't claim that the Constitution entrenches my views. I recognize that this is a matter that's left to the democratic processes. I'd submit that the claim that there's a constitutional right to same-sex marriage is wholly implausible. Throughout the history of our country, as virtually everywhere else in the world, marriage has always been a union of man and woman. That was true in every state at the time that the Constitution came into effect. That was true in every state at the time that the post-Civil War amendments were adopted. And as a historical matter, no one contends that the post-Civil War amendments were directed against this traditional understanding of marriage or that they had anything to do with homosexuality. So in the face of all this, claims for a constitutional right to same-sex marriage rest on some combination of the following. One, freewheeling constitutional theorizing that's nothing more than camouflaged imposition of one's own moral preferences. Two, profound confusion about what marriage is all about and what its core purpose is. And three, treating as indisputable fact highly contestable assertions that are the very stuff of policy debate. As it happens, Judge Von Walker's ruling in the Prop 8 case in California illustrates all these flaws and more. Let's begin with the purpose of marriage. The purpose of marriage is to manage the sexually based phenomenon known as procreation. The traditional definition of marriage reflects the elementary biological reality that only opposite sex unions naturally generate children. Marriage arose and exists to encourage men and women to create the next generation in the right context and to discourage the creation of children in other contexts, out of wedlock homes, fatherless homes. This traditional understanding of marriage did not arise in connection with homosexuality in any way. I'll address shortly the non-fertile couple red herring. Now, this understanding, until it was convenient in the last couple decades to deny it for political reasons, was widely accepted across the board by everyone. Go back to William Blackstone describing the relationship of husband and wife as founded in nature but modified by civil society, the one directing man to continue and multiply his species, the other prescribing the manner in which that natural impulse must be confined and regulated. Blackstone talks about the relationship of parent and child as consequential to that of marriage, being its principal end and design. It is by virtue of this relation that infants are protected, maintained, and educated. Anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss, no conservative, the family based on a union, more or less durable, but socially approved, of two individuals of opposite sexes who establish a household and bear and raise children, appears to be a practically universal phenomenon present in every type of society. Sociologist Kingsley Davis, very much the same. Now, in the face of all this, let's look at what Judge Walker had to say. I could spend hours on his opinion. I don't have that time. I'll try to be brief. But first, in describing what he called the certain characteristics that marriage has retained throughout the history of the United States, here's what Judge Walker said. Two parties give their free consent to form a relationship, which then forms the foundation of a household. Ah, yes, two parties. I now pronounce you party and party. Okay, that doesn't capture, Judge Walker doesn't acknowledge that the male-female nature of traditional marriage is part of the core of traditional marriage. Now, one can acknowledge that and still dispute that that ought to be that way, but to not even acknowledge that is pretty remarkable. He's, of course, willfully blind to marriage's connection to procreation. He says, as though this is dispositive, never has a state inquired into procreative capacity or intent before issuing a marriage license. One hears this argument often, as Jonathan points out, under rational basis review, this is not this has no weight. But I also want to point out how empty it is, even on its own terms. The child-raising purpose of marriage is advanced even when a husband and wife can't procreate together because one of them is infertile, as the marital obligation of fidelity helps ensure that the fertile spouse doesn't have children outside the marriage. That purpose is also advanced, of course, when a husband and wife don't intend to procreate because lots of Married couples who don't intend to procreate either change their minds or end up procreating, notwithstanding their intent. And of course, fertility is not something that's simple to determine. We're not going to have some sort of Orwellian police trying to determine whether or not someone is fertile. The law often presumes fertility. We all know from our property classes the fertile octogenarian. And there are, you know, just plenty of countervailing privacy reasons why the state wouldn't be exploring procreative capacity. Now, Judge Walker also claimed that the evidence shows beyond any doubt, this is a quote, that parents' genders are irrelevant to children's developmental outcomes. Beyond any doubt. And further, that the genetic relationship between a parent and a child is not related to a child's adjustment outcomes. I suppose this means perhaps we ought to have random assignment of children around the nation to anyone willing to raise them, because it's beyond any doubt that this wouldn't have an impact on their outcomes. Look, social science cannot possibly settle this question to the degree of certainty that Judge Walker claims. It's perfectly reasonable for folks to rely on the sort of social science that Judge Walker invokes to make their public policy arguments. It's equally reasonable for others to rely on other social science evidence or on their own good common sense in opposing that. But the idea that social science is going to establish this, I think, is an illusion that cannot be sustained. The final point I make about Judge Walker's ruling is he also claims that the state interest in proceeding with caution and saying, look, let's see how this happens elsewhere before you adopt it here, that is irrational. He claims that the evidence shows beyond debate, again, this absolutist terminology, that allowing same-sex couples to marry has at least a neutral, if not a positive, effect on the institution of marriage. Beyond debate. Well, as even Jonathan Rauch, a prominent proponent of same-sex marriage, has written, that kind of sweeping certainty about the future doesn't fit an unpredictable world. Jonathan Rauch, to his credit, decried Judge Walker's radical ruling, his term radical. And the evidence that Judge Walker cites in support of this proposition being beyond debate is trivial. First and foremost, data showing that annual rates for marriage and divorce in Massachusetts didn't change during the 4 years following judicial imposition of same-sex marriage in Massachusetts. A grand total of 4 years of data limited to annual marriage and divorce rates. Even the expert for plaintiff who submitted that evidence said, you can't rely on this to make any grand conclusions. And another expert said the long-term effects of same-sex marriage are impossible to tell. Well, I'll leave it there for now. A lot more that we can go into. But the bottom line here is that this is an issue that should be debated in the political processes. I have no illusions that I'm guaranteed victory for my views in the political processes. I will accept as legitimate defeats that happen there. Whereas if there's judicial imposition of this constitutional right, I think we're going to have a decades-long battle that makes the fight over Roe seem like peanuts by comparison. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I thank you for having me come. As will be no surprise, I have a somewhat different view on the constitutionality of a current marriage regulation, and I'll try to explain why in the little time that I have. First I'll look at due process. Let's think about due process. Now, certainly the court has articulated the test that we heard, something has to be within the traditions and conscience of the people. We're going to talk about this fundamental interests, the non-recognition of which would deny liberty. And this is, the court has said this, but let's also think about the kinds of interests that have been recognized as fundamental. So let's start thinking about abortion, contraception, and I'll talk about Lawrence in a little bit. When you think about the interests that fall within the fundamental right to privacy, very few, if any of them, meet that test. Abortion had been criminalized for at least 90 years before it was recognized as fundamental. Contraception, even when used by two individuals who are married, much less individuals who are not married, long criminalized. So we could take the test that the court has offered. The only difficulty is that it doesn't account for the rights that have been recognized as fundamental. And let's go to the marriage cases. You think of Loving versus Virginia, which of course is an equal protection case where Virginia had precluded individuals from marrying if they were of different races, but the court also said this is a fundamental right, but Virginia had precluded this very kind of marriage since before the nation's founding. So the court has articulated a test, that is true. It does not account for those rights that have been recognized. So that at least makes you think there must be something else that can help us distinguish which rights are fundamental and which not. Well, we might start thinking about what do the interests serve? And marriage serves a lot of interests, societal and individual. And if we think of individual interests, we might think of the adults in the relationship and the children who are brought up within the family. Now, it is certainly true that both same-sex and different-sex couples are raising children, and this is true in many parts of the nation. Now, children, much research suggests, are helped by stability, and we get a kind of correlation between stability and marriage. Now, whether same-sex marriage is recognized is not going to affect, or at least is not going to prevent same-sex couples from raising children, which is one of the things Judge Walker was speaking to. Rather, what it's going to do is help cement the relationship, the place in which they're raised. Now, whether or not you're helping those children is not going to affect the other families who are also raising children. This is the kind of insight that Judge Walker has. This is why he believes that precluding individuals in California from marrying did not have a rational basis, much less meet a higher level of scrutiny. Now, we have both due process and equal protection. How do we look at the equal protection? First, we have to consider what the basis of classification is. Are we discriminating or classifying on the basis of sex, or are we classifying on the basis of orientation? Now, if you look at the statutes, basically they're saying a man can only marry a woman can only marry a man. That's what those states not recognizing same-sex marriage are saying. At the very least, this looks to be a classification on the basis of sex. A separate issue is whether the state can meet its burden. But we also might look at some of the cases, and we've had a lot of them in the state courts, analyzing state constitutional grounds. It might be noted that in none of those cases where courts were looking at the same-sex marriage ban under either intermediate scrutiny or strict scrutiny, did the court uphold the same-sex marriage ban? Now, a separate issue is whether you can rationally support that. Then we can talk about, well, okay, is this discrimination that only gets rational basis? Even if we're looking at it that way, let's look at some of the federal jurisprudence. I have no idea where I am.
Oh, you're fine. You have 2 minutes.
Great. Okay. So let us look at some of the cases under rational basis, the least difficult standard. But then we start to think of, well, one, Romer. Two, Lawrence. Right. Now, if you remember, in Lawrence versus Texas, the court struck down a Texas law which criminalized same-sex sodomy. Said you can't do it. Now, if this... First of all, the question is, what level of scrutiny did they use? Suppose we say it is rational basis. Then the question would be, could the state have some reason to criminalize relations outside of marriage? Now, if you want to do the history and tradition, historically, the state, of course, has been thought to have a reason. So then we're going to have to figure out what's going on. One, either what's going on is the interest involved in having sexual relations is getting higher scrutiny. But by the way, if that's true, presumably marriage should be getting higher scrutiny. So after Lawrence, if same-sex relations, sexual relations is protected, you would expect that same-sex relationships like marriage would also be protected, or we get a kind of understanding that what the court articulates as the test can't really be the test. Why? Because traditionally, the various interests that have been found protected by the Constitution have all been thought to be rationally, we could get rational prohibitions, whether it's abortion, whether it's sex outside of marriage, contraception, all of these. So whether we're going to look at equal protection or we're going to look at due process, one, it's pretty clear the traditional test invoked doesn't account for the jurisprudence. Two, the cases that we have at least suggest either a kind of higher level of scrutiny for statutes that adversely affect members of the lesbian gay community under Romer, under Lawrence, or even more strongly, if it's a discrimination on the basis of sex, it would be very difficult to see the exceedingly persuasive justification that a state could offer to justify limiting marriage to different sex couples. Thank you.
Professor Adler, would you like to take 3 minutes to offer additional comments?
Yeah, I'll just make a couple brief comments. First is I think that we're just looking at the application what sort of scrutiny we should apply and look at cases like Romer and Lawrence. I think we can easily distinguish the question of marriage from what's at issue in those cases. Just look at Lawrence. First of all, one justice did offer an equal protection rationale in Lawrence, Justice O'Connor, a fairly narrow one that focused on the criminalization of conduct based on the gender of the participants. But that was not the rationale adopted by the court. But I think nonetheless, in Lawrence, one should recognize that there is a difference between saying the state may not criminalize certain conduct and saying the state must privilege or recognize the acceptability of certain conduct. And this is actually something we see in the abortion jurisprudence. Right? So for example, Justice Kennedy, who tends to control the outcome in these sorts of issues, did join the plurality in the Casey decision, saying that states could not prohibit abortion. But also in that plurality and in subsequent opinions has made clear, and the court has made clear, that the state is not required to be neutral and may adopt policies that expressly disfavor abortion, and that even that create obstacles to abortion so long as they do not create a substantial obstacle to a large number of women who may be seeking abortion. Right? So that even in areas like the abortion jurisprudence, we see this distinction between saying you're not going to allow the state to criminalize certain behavior and requiring the state to approve or solemnize or recognize a certain behavior. The other thing I just mentioned is that even under intermediate scrutiny, and again, the cases about citizenship of children born to one parent who's a citizen and one parent who's a non-citizen, I think are instructive in this case because some of them, at least one of them, occurs after VMI, which is arguably the most stringent application of intermediate scrutiny that we've seen, say that they're recognizing traditional gendered biological roles about parenting is consistent with that intermediate scrutiny, and that is consistent with the requirement that certain types of gender-based restrictions recognize or celebrate biologically grounded gender differences as opposed to being a basis for penalizing people. And I think that the arguments that are made in favor of maintaining marriage as has been traditionally defined, I think fit comfortably within that framework, especially when one recognizes that the adverse consequences to, for example, the child who is born of a citizen parent and a non-citizen parent, but the wrong one was the citizen, to be able to take advantage of citizens of the United States are far more severe in terms of a practical measure, far more punitive, in fact. And there's even case law suggesting that certain sorts of immigration consequences like deportation should be seen as somewhat punitive than the states refusing to recognize in some sort of formal way relationships that people voluntarily enter into. So even if we go to the higher scrutiny, I still think that states are not required to recognize same-sex marriage.
Let me try to make three quick points. First, an area of agreement or perhaps near agreement with Mark, insofar as we're trying to predict what the court as currently composed might do, I offer no prediction. I would perhaps reinterpret Mark's comment about how, how the current test can account for the results as a criticism of the court, not as an excuse for the court to engage in more of that. And I would say that the original public meaning ought to be a check against the runaway autonomy of certain judicially invented doctrines. Second point, this gets entirely to the policy question on same-sex marriage, which, you know, Mark raised the legitimate interest of the concerns of children and same-sex couple families. In any assessment of the overall calculus, that is certainly part of it. What I would dispute, though, is the proposition that same-sex marriage will have no impact on other people's children. Maybe not folks you can identify right away, but I think there's a concept of mission confusion. You know, the more you separate the institution of marriage and laws of marriage from its purpose, the more, you know, children will suffer. Marriage exists for these reasons, for raising children. If we lose sight of that purpose, maybe we can't point them out right now, and maybe, you know, millions of children yet unborn who will suffer as a result, as the institution of marriage suffers further decline. On that same point, I'll add that the children of parents who oppose same-sex marriage, who would be stigmatized as irrational bigots, I think those children, you know, we ought also be concerned about them. Our system has a way of dealing with folks deemed irrational bigots. We marginalize them and penalize them and exclude them from all sorts of benefits in public life. Their children will suffer as well, and that would include, evidently, President Obama's children. And third, I would highlight the internal contradiction between two different sets of arguments that same-sex marriage advocates make. On the one hand, they say studies show that the children of same-sex couples do as well as anyone else. On the other hand, there's supposedly this very costly stigma from the denial of marriage. I don't see how both can exist. My final third point would simply be that the very arguments we hear for a constitutional right to same-sex marriage cannot, on grounds of principle, explain why you wouldn't have a constitutional right for adult incest, and also cannot explain on principle, I'd submit, why you can't have a constitutional right to polygamy. Let me make one clarification here, because lots of folks like to jump on this. I am not comparing homosexuality to adult incest or to polygamy. I'm saying that the principle has these certain implications. I think it's obvious enough on adult incest. On polygamy, why this arbitrary 2 versus 3 versus 7? You know, if there are people who can only find their fulfillment, the grand love in a group of 7, what possible reason is there to deny them that? And surely, you can make arguments about administrative benefits. You can divvy those up. So again, I think that the argument ultimately for same-sex marriage has these implications that same-sex marriage advocates generally refuse to acknowledge.
And let me make just a few points. First, if you think of Lawrence, it might be noted, although the court said, look, I'm not talking about marriage. The court was very clear there, and I'm not saying that it was. But it's also true, the court based its opinion in part not merely on the importance of having sexual relations, but talked about the dignity, the importance of the enduring relationship that might be involved by the parties, giving constitutional weight not just to, for example, a one-night stand, but the relationship itself. And I suspect if you're giving constitutional weight to that, it's going to be much harder to argue that Lawrence should stand, but a same-sex marriage ban is also okay. Traditionally, we have valued and said there is constitutional weight to relationships over individual relations, and Lawrence inverts it. And we'll see what happens if a case goes before the court, whether the court is going to ignore this traditional greater valuing of marriage than simple sexual relations on a perhaps just on one occasion. With respect to parenting, many states, including Florida now, will permit members of the lesbian, gay, transsexual community to adopt children, to be raising children. So to say you can't marry because we're going to prevent the parenting is to ignore that the states are saying, go ahead and parent, but we're not going to allow you this additional benefit that might be secured by marriage. Now, marriage, I suspect, is sort of a political football. One of the reasons that we may get welfare to be as good when raised by lesbian and gay parents as by general populace, we have to remember that our marriage rate is actually not so very high right now. And it's not because of, you know, lesbians and gays and what they're doing, but our marriage rate is going down. And that may be one of the ways to reconcile the surprising results that you see. And one more point about incest, by the way, is incest, given that it's presumably, this might be between a man and a woman, right? Either first cousin, sister, brother, whoever this is, that's going to need independent analysis as to why you can't have that, but it's not just based on the genders. Presumably, their power dynamics, their biological worries about children, there are all kinds of things that are cited. But that has to be done independently. And for polygamous relationships, you know, when the courts look at polygamy, what do they say? They look at this with strict scrutiny and then perhaps uphold the regulation. Fair enough. All I'm suggesting, if you can uphold the regulation, the ban of same-sex marriage under strict scrutiny, fair enough, but no interests have been articulated by anyone that would suffice under that standard. So, you know, I will take the comparison to polygamy because the courts actually take seriously that it's a marriage and then talk about why they're very important interests that would have to be sacrificed to recognize. Whereas we haven't had those articulated yet to justify same-sex marriage bans, which, fair enough, are throughout the country, except with, you know, well, several states, but most states do not allow, but without the articulation of the important interests that you would expect would be articulated to justify such a policy.
All right, well, do you have questions? We do.
Quick comment and question for Professor Adler. I think your last point, I think that you have articulated those. I think people like Jennifer Lack-Morse and others who have written on this topic do provide articulation. They could even survive a strict scrutiny standard. So I just a point of information there. My question to Professor Adler was more specific to the Proposition 8 case and the appeal that's being, we just argued this week. And just our Ted Olson's and Boyce's arguments to the appeals board, do you find those compelling in any way? It sounds like to me you do not. Could you expand on that a little bit?
No, I don't. And it's I was actually listening to the oral argument on the way down here, and Ted Olson, who I have a tremendous amount of respect for, and who I have seen deliver what I would characterize as some fairly masterful and compelling oral arguments, I was not. You know, as much as I agree with the policy outcome, and I actually think there are quite conservative, almost Burkean arguments related to some of the facts on the ground that Mark mentioned, that why gay marriage is prudentially something that is in the best interest of society and in the best interest of children. So, I mean, I as much as I have a lot of sympathy for those arguments, I don't find them compelling. I don't believe that. I don't believe that Olson has been able to demonstrate that there is not a rational basis for the state wanting to change a tradition slowly, wanting to know more about what the likely effects are going to be, let alone those relating to recognizing the traditional benefits that marriage is believed to provide. And it's something that's debated in the social science literature, but certainly under a rational basis test, and I think even under intermediate scrutiny, it is hard to say, look at the existing social science literature and say, there is no way a state could want to maintain these questions. The argument that Ted Olson makes that we haven't talked about is this, and that comes up in the oral argument, is this idea that there's something different about a right being taken away from one being granted in the or being denied initially. And the Ninth Circuit seemed particularly interested in this idea, and Roman versus Evans being part of the impetus for that. I don't find that argument particularly compelling for a couple reasons. One, I think in a state where you allow a ballot initiative, in part so as to correct erroneous state Supreme Court opinions, then the people should essentially be viewed as the state's highest tribunal. And so what and the opinion of the California Supreme Court is to the view of the people through an initiative, ballot initiative, equivalent to a lower court as to the Supreme Court. And so one should not see it as though there was a constitutional right under the Constitution of California that suddenly was repealed. No, the state Supreme Court thought that you interpreted this Constitution one way, and the people said, no, you've interpreted it wrong, and we were going to correct that, number one. Number two, I think that Romer versus Evans actually, and there are some other cases along these lines, there's some school integration-related cases that involve similar dynamics, I think is best under, and you know, Romer is in some respects one of these, you know, Kennedy inkblots that we can all interpret in various ways, but I think is best understood as being concerned not simply with the changing in a policy to the detriment of a group, because that can't be the constitutional test, because then you have a ratchet. And I don't think that is something that we can reconcile with our constitutional traditions. But rather, what the amendment did in Romer essentially was to say that gays and lesbians could not avail themselves of the political process to seek certain types of protection against public and private discrimination that any other group could. So for example, after the ballot initiative in Colorado, a family-oriented group could go to the City Council of Aspen and say, don't allow private landlords to discriminate against families with young children in deciding who to rent to or not rent to. But gays and lesbians could not go to the City Council and seek the same sort of protection and positive law. And there's a lot of language in Roe versus Evans, and again, there are some prior cases in other contexts that relate to similar principles. It's concerned with not the outcome of the political process, which is what we see in California with Prop 8, but a shifting of the political process. And I think there is a very different argument about state constitutional amendments or other things which affect the ability of various groups to avail themselves of the political process to seek desired public policy outcomes from losing within the political process. And I don't think that the proponents of or the opponents of Prop 8 have really dealt with that. You know, what the Ninth Circuit will do, you know, who knows?
Yes.
I have a question about the line of Lawrence and Griswold and so forth. My recollection is Lawrence talked about the criminalization of sodomy as wrong because it was primarily private conduct that did not have a public impact, which of course was based on Griswold and what we're talking about, our right to privacy. And you know, it built upon the old Wolfenden report, which said this is private conduct, not public conduct, and therefore you don't have a public interest in giving a public status, a bad status in the case of Lawrence, to fundamentally private conduct. And it seems to me here we're talking about giving a public status, a positive status, to what Lawrence has already declared to be fundamentally private conduct, which makes me question, you know, I understand that you say, well then, isn't marriage between a man and a woman in the same category? It's marriage between a man and a man, or a woman, and therefore you have the discrimination thing. But in terms of, say, Lawrence goes through, it seems to me that's problematic. And in terms of between a man and a woman, the fact is that bearing and raising children for individuals is optional, for societies it's absolutely essential, and that every study I've ever seen says that being raised by your natural father and your natural mother gives you the best, the ideal, which means that at least like cigarette smoking is something that society has a right to encourage, that you don't do the one and do the other, notwithstanding the fact the second best may in some cases be the best that someone can do.
And let me do two things. One, you know, one way to have understood Lawrence might be just to say, look, private conduct, this is a place that the state ought not be going, right? And you can do that. It's just that Lawrence also says, although it's not the holding, I suppose, but also talks about the value of the relationships. Also note that Lawrence seems to be rejecting the rationality of the states regulating extramarital conduct. If we're really going to buy it as a rational basis test, that for a long time had been thought to be a kind of rational basis. For many of the families who are raising children, they are not taking children from their biological parents, taking them and putting them in a what is argued to be a less optimal situation, notwithstanding the statistics showing no differences. Instead, what's happening, and I can tell you, so we can start to do the differences, but note what's going on when you are comparing. So let's look at who we're comparing. But oh, sorry, first let me finish my point. Basically, children are in need, in many cases, children are in need of being placed. And one place that they're going is homes of lesbian and gay couples. And the children are doing a lot better than they would be doing otherwise. And precisely because you're not taking the children away from their biological parents, but in fact offering them a better place, this hardly should be a reason to prevent the home where they're getting a better place to be even better through accessing marriage. And note, if you look at Lawrence and you see the citing of Griswold and Eisenstadt, all the privacy cases, at least one question that comes to mind is, why are you doing the privacy cases if this is mere sort of sexual relations, unless those, either those relations are getting stricter scrutiny, or the relationships are, because otherwise the response you ought to be getting is, well, wait a minute, you cited those cases. Those cases have nothing to do with this. This doesn't fall in the right of privacy. This is just a mistake. So the very fact, if you look at Lawrence, did you see the privacy cases? I suspect that's a signal that something very important is at issue, and the court is going to have some difficulty later on saying, oh yes, this is protected, but marriage, I don't think so.
If I can say, I think it's actually relatively easy to say, again, as they've done in the abortion cases, there is a difference between saying the state can't criminalize certain conduct and saying the state has to be neutral towards certain conduct or certain relationships. And one of the reasons Lawrence relies on all those privacy cases, I would argue, actually, because there is a tradition in our public law, that in some respects the court in Bowers may have even gotten wrong, of recognizing a difference between state intrusions into the privacy of one's home and to things that occur shielded from the eyes of the public, and things that occur in the public square. And the state sanction or recognition of marriage is, and you know, as a libertarian, I wish marriage was a purely private institution, but it's not. Recognition of marriage is something that occurs in the public square. The relationship at issue in Lawrence is something that occurs shielded from public gaze in private. And I think that is a line which there actually is a lot of history and support for, as well as a lot of history and support for the idea that there's a difference between the state criminalizing certain sexual acts and criminalizing the acts based on who the participants are. And I can't remember if it was the Cato brief or one of the briefs in Lawrence actually pointed this out, that distinguishing homosexual from heterosexual sodomy historically was actually a relatively recent development in criminal law, and that there are all sorts of structural reasons why you might be willing to say if a legislature is willing to criminalize conduct for everybody, you know, let them deal with the voters. We're only going to be concerned if they're criminalizing it for a certain subset of the population.
Mark, if I may throw in a quick thought before you offer any response to Jonathan, I guess I'm puzzled by your not seeing the conduct in Lawrence as falling within what people would call privacy, irrespective of what the scope of the constitutional right of privacy is. I mean, certainly homosexual conduct in one's room seems to partake more of what one think of privacy than abortion in some doctor's office. So I'm not understanding. Again, that doesn't go to the question whether this is within the scope of some constitutional right of privacy, but the conduct at issue seems more private than other things the court has called within the realm of right of privacy.
Sure, and this is right, but look, so all I'm talking about, one, when we talk about the right to privacy, we are triggering all kinds of interests and analyses. That's what I'm talking about with privacy. Is this private matter? Sure. Of course this is a private matter. Just the opinion goes beyond merely treating this as a private matter, and the work that's done by Griswold, Eisenstadt, the privacy cases, is not merely saying, state, you shouldn't be in here, especially because, as a by the way, traditionally, the state has been allowed to regulate even in the private sphere, especially something like sexual relations outside of marriage.
Right.
So there's just a lot of work that's being done that isn't accounted for by the read of Lawrence that's being offered.
Well, I know you have more questions, but unfortunately we don't have more time. So we're going to have to wrap it up there. If you like today's program, I'd encourage you to join our Federalist Society. We have forms outside. Please see me or another one of our officers if you're interested. And in any event, please join me in thanking our speakers for this great discussion.